ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle. And of course, as always, if this is your first time listening or you just recently started listening to us, thank you so much. We really do love hearing from you, and let us know what you think of this episode or any other episodes or about anything you'd like us to cover in the future. Now, today, it was our pleasure to welcome one of Ireland's most admired journalists into the studio to talk about her 3 decades writing about this country.
When you're working as a journalist, you just switch onto automatic pilot. And yes, the fear is there in your head, but the foremost thing is getting the story and being there on time and not being beaten by the rivals. And I am so grateful to journalism because it has made me live. And it's brought me right to the edge so many times. You know, I covered the Troubles frequently in the north, and there were some very hairy times. I went to Lebanon, and I look back now and I've had such a privileged life, and I have these amazing stories to tell. And I wouldn't have had that if journalism hadn't made me move out of my comfort zone.
That was the wonderful Justine McCarthy there, and we're going to hear a lot more from her in a moment. But first, finally, the government has announced plans to hold a referendum to delete the reference in the Constitution to the women's role in the home, with the date of March 8th, International Women's Day, very good there, likely to be the polling day. So Pat Leahy was writing about it this week in the Irish Times. He says that it's also expected the proposal will include inserting into the Constitution a recognition of family carers and also an aspiration that the state should, quotes, strive to support the provision of care in the home. Now, apparently the proposal was discussed at a cabinet committee meeting on Monday, and it's likely to be brought to next week's government meeting for approval because it will require an act to be passed by the Oireachtas proposing to amend the Constitution with the agreed wording before a public information campaign about the changes is undertaken by the new Electoral Commission, the state body that regulates and oversees elections and referendums. So it's likely that that legislation will be introduced to the Oireachtas before Christmas, but the time for debate is likely to be constrained by the relatively tight timetable. If you remember, the government committed to holding a referendum this year, but officials and politicians failed to agree a final wording despite several months of wrangling. Leahy reports that there was considerable anxiety among many senior politicians that a referendum campaign could turn into a debate on family, gender and gender roles. I mean, shock horror, imagine having to debate that, which politicians feared could be divisive. Anyway, after extensive deliberations, a citizen assembly reported in June 2021 that the Constitution should be amended to refer explicitly to gender equality and non-discrimination. It also said Article 41 of the Constitution, which refers to the family, should be amended so that it would protect private and family life with the protection afforded to the family, not limited to the marital family. As you know, the Article 41.2 refers to women's, quotes, duties in the home, and the Citizens' Assembly suggested that should be deleted and replaced with language that is not gender specific and obliges the state to take reasonable measures to support care within the home. We've talked about it here on the podcast many, many times. It's long been viewed by many as anachronistic, but agreement on how to amend it has been really hard to come by. The article in full says that the state recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state shall therefore endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in the home. Oh my God, every time I read it out, I just nearly get sick. It is understood that no change is likely to be proposed to the articles which deal with the rights of the family, which is defined as being based on marriage in the Constitution. So it doesn't look like they're going to change that, even though many of us, including me, are in a family where there isn't any marriage. But anyway, they obviously don't really care. However, the new wording will include recognition by the state that the provision of care by family members to each other by reason of the bonds that exist among them gives a support to society without which the common good cannot be achieved. The state, it is expected to say, shall strive to support such provision. So we will definitely have an episode all about the woman in the home, how it came to be, why it shouldn't be there. But imagine, it's going to be really interesting, that referendum campaign, if there's actually people voting to keep it in, you know, that'll be just kind of fascinating to see. And I'm sure there will be the usual suspects saying that women's duties in the home are really important. And anyway, we'll have a great laugh discussing it, because I'm hoping it will be voted by a vast majority to remove it from the Constitution. But watch this space, and we'll definitely do at least one episode about it before March 8th, International Women's Day. Now, Justine McCarthy is an award-winning journalist with over a dozen awards to her name and another one added to her collection this week. She writes a weekly Irish Times column every Friday, which makes for absolutely brilliant reading every single week. She has been an adjunct professor of journalism at the University of Limerick. She's the author of two books, Mary McAleese, The Outsider, that was in 1999, an unauthorised biography of the former President of Ireland, and Deep Deception from 2009 about the sexual abuse of young swimmers by their coaches, published by O'Brien Press. Her latest book, her third, is An Eye on Ireland, and it's a collection of her columns and journalism over 30 years. I was delighted to have this conversation with her. She is fascinating. She is so articulate. She's just a really brilliant person to listen to, and she has really seen this country change over the last three decades. I began by congratulating my colleague Justine McCarthy about her recent award. Justine, I just want to begin by congratulating you on your Columnist of the Year award at the National Journalism Awards. Well done. Delighted that that happened. How did that feel?
Well,
not your first award, I have to say.
Doubly wonderful that I won it for columns for the Irish Times, because the Irish Times has always been for me the pinnacle of Irish newspapers, and it's taken me an awful long, many years to get here.
But I did notice reading your book that actually, and I was delighted to see it, the very first article you ever had published was in the Irish Times. So there's something about the thread that's finally come together.
I think it
was about some rowers in Trinity College discrimination.
Exactly, against
like
the
that.
Women rowers and Trinity Rowing Club. Yeah.
So I think that says it all, that you started there and now you're here and you're right on a Friday in the column pages, and an absolutely brilliant column it is, and well-deserved that award. So you have a book out, it's called An Eye on Ireland, and it's new and selected journalism. It's reading it, it's really the story of Ireland changing, I think, and we'll talk a lot about that. And you've been witness to all of that from your days as a young journalist right up to now, and it's fascinating from that point of view. But you also write an opening essay to sort of put yourself in context, I suppose, and I found it very interesting because I know you a little bit in real life, but lots of things I didn't know about you. And you always strike me from your writing as such a courageous person, someone who I feel is a bit fearless. But reading your opening essay about who you were as a young girl and the challenges you had to overcome, you were quite the timid person. Tell us about you as a girl, what you were like.
Well, I'm still quite timid. Even coming in here today, I had to take the stairs because I couldn't get into the lift. So I have my phobias, but I've learned to manage them more. As a child, I was perpetually frightened of things that never happened. People didn't frighten me, but the fragility of life was always something in my head. So I was terrified of planes passing overhead. I was terrified. We lived on the outskirts of a town called Bandon in West Cork, and there was a big empty mansion across the road from us, surrounded by woods. And I was always terrified of that house. I literally was the child who was scared of the dark, but I was also scared of the light and everything else. And I attribute that, Róisín, to the sudden death of my father when I was four. He went out to work one day and he never came home. And I suppose there's nothing to equal that to impress on a young mind how vulnerable human life is, that you don't know the hour or the day. And so that, I think, has always been in me since the age of four.
And it happened at four, and you actually have quite a vivid memory of like, maybe not the details, but the moment. You describe people coming into the house and it felt like the light had gone out of everything.
Yes.
I think that's what you said.
Yeah, I remember my uncle and an adult male cousin walking up the stairs in big, heavy, dark overcoats. And my sister, who's 2 years older than me, Adrienne, and I were on the landing playing with our dolls. And I remember looking up and seeing these, they're almost like silhouettes, and they blocked out all the light. And it's as if the light stayed off then, until my next memory is I was in the back kitchen of our house. We grew up in a typical country town business house, so we had a big service kitchen at the back of the bar. And that's when the light comes on in my memory later that evening. And the walls of the back kitchen being lined with these silent men standing all around. And there were the men from the yard who actually made the coffins for our undertaking business and drove taxis. And
so, sorry, that's interesting. I mean, your dad has died and you make, there's an undertaking business
exactly.
in your family. So that's...
Yes. And our family business would have buried him. So that night, I remember, it was a December night, so it's always dark outside the window in my memory. But my memory of that is following Birdie O'Mahony, who was the lovely woman who looked after us four daughters, as she was going around pouring out tea for the men. And I can see myself following her around the kitchen saying, "But what does dead mean? When is Daddy coming home?" And Róisín, the most amazing thing happened to me. 2 weeks ago, I went to Bandon to do a book signing session in my hometown. And when I came around the corner to the bookshop, the first person I saw was Birdie O'Mahony, now aged 93, in a wheelchair, fully compos mentis, with her son, who told us that as he was growing up, he always heard from his mother about we four sisters and how much she had loved us. She wasn't married at that stage. Mm. And I actually told her that day that, you know, I know that when I was a child, there were moments when I was confused as to who was my mother. Was it Birdie or my mother? Because they even looked similar. They both had black hair and they wore black a lot. Yeah, so that was a wonderful day.
Yeah, that was brilliant to reconnect with her. And I'm just thinking as I'm listening to you and from reading it as well, I think there's the germs of the writer there. Clearly the observing was happening as a young age. You were noticing these details. These things stand out to you. And I think there's something there about writers that are noticing things.
So, yes,
I don't know if you feel like that, but I sort of
I do remember. I can feel the atmosphere.
Yeah. You spoke about your mum there and how she looked like Birdie. I love that name. I presume that wasn't her real name, though, Birdie, was it?
I think that might have been a pet
Bridget
name
for
Bridget,
yeah.
Which was my mother's name also.
Oh, so and she was called Bride, your mother.
Yeah.
You're right. So sounds like an amazing woman, very attractive looking woman. She had this sort of Spanish, you didn't get the Spanish looking
no,
jeans.
I didn't. I'm like my father.
You've got this chop of curly
look.
Blonde hair and the freckles.
Yeah.
But tell me about her, because you do say in the book that she was the first feminist you ever met.
Yes, but I don't think she would have realised that herself, certainly at the time.
Well,
they didn't use that word, did they?
They probably didn't know what that even meant.
And she would have been very conscious of her physical beauty and her femininity, and she loved clothes and she was glamorous, and she loved that people used to say, oh, she was like Jackie Onassis, you know, she wore big sunglasses.
I bet you have amazing pictures of her, do you?
Yeah, some beautiful pictures. But she was a country girl. She grew up on a farm in East Cork in Carrick Tool. She met my father in November 1 year. She was engaged to another man at the time. She handed back the ring to that man and got engaged to my father a month later, and they were married 2 months later. So it was the, you know, the quintessential whirlwind romance.
I think you say that he kissed her and it felt like being whacked by a combine harvester or
exactly.
something.
That's what she used to tell us. It was like being hit by a combine harvester, which apparently is the ultimate in romantic moments.
Talk about the earth moving.
But then, of course, she moved to Bandon, which was on the other side of Cork City. And in those days, would have been very remote from East Cork. And then suddenly found herself one day with four daughters aged from 10 down to a year old, with a very kind of diverse business and lots of tax headaches. And she used to tell us that she didn't know how to change a light bulb when our father died. And she had worked in the business, but front of house, the charming woman behind the bar. She used to do some of the funerals as well. But now she was landed with all this administration plus four daughters.
And she was only 39.
She was only 39, yeah.
So how did she cope with that?
With great difficulty. I think she found it very lonely, first of all. I do remember her saying that as a widow, she suddenly found that she wasn't invited out to social events, which is something I have found myself since I have been widowed. That's one of the things that hasn't actually changed very much in society. She had a very, very good friend called Mary Taff, who, you know, was a great support to her. And Mary had been widowed herself in her 20s and had three sons. But I think the fact that Mum had four daughters made it more difficult. So I do have that column in the book about my eldest sister, Bernice, who became pregnant when she was 20.
Yeah.
And not married. And this was a scandal, and it was the worst thing a girl could do.
This was 1974.
Like that, yeah. And for Mum, the problem was not just how to deal with Bernice's predicament, but how to protect her three younger sisters from the stigma as well. And I feel terribly sad about what happened to Bernice. I absolutely idolized her. She looked like my mother. She was very glamorous. She was a beauty therapist working in Cork City. And she ended up going to England and having her baby.
And sitting out the pregnancy there and having the baby and then coming back. And initially sort of hoped that even though it was this big scandal and it was a different Ireland, that she might be able to keep
yes.
her
she,
son.
She had made an arrangement with a woman she befriended in England that woman would adopt the baby. But when he was born, Duncan, Bernice couldn't part with him. So she left the hospital and got on a plane to Cork and brought him home to Bandon. And she had him in Bandon for 10 days and realised she just wasn't going to be able to do this. Such was the taboo at the time. And she rang the other woman who came over to Bandon and brought the baby back to England with her. And within months then, Bernice went to live in South Africa and never came home. She went there to start a new life, clean sheet. And I'm glad to say she met the most wonderful man there and they married and had two other sons. And I'm in constant contact with them. And her first grandchild was born during the summer.
No.
And they called him Liam after my father, Billy.
Because she died in her early 50s, is that right?
4 days after her 51st birthday, yeah. So he was, when Duncan made contact with us, he was just too late. We had to tell him his mum had died. But she had written him a beautiful letter and given it to his adoptive mum to give to him on his 18th birthday or his 21st birthday, I can't remember, and a stunning photograph of herself. So he knew she loved him and he knew that she had made the ultimate sacrifice for what she believed was, you know, the best for him.
And I imagine it's interesting, isn't it, Justine, that you went on then to write about what happened to other women in those situations, people who ended up in mother and baby homes and people in Magdalene laundries and all of that. What kind of an impression did that family story make on you as a young girl? Because you were 4 years younger than Bernice, is that right? Or how?
I was 6 years younger.
6 years younger. Yeah, so yeah. You would have been around
14
when this was all happening. Yes. So aware of what was going on or not aware. I'm sure some of it was hidden from you. And
yeah.
But do you remember what impression it made at the time?
Well, you know, you won't remember this, but in those days, women, girls, didn't even articulate words like sex or vagina or penis or, you know, or toilet even. You know, it was so Victorian. And for this to happen, it was a big family secret. I didn't tell anybody in school. It had a huge effect on me, first of all, because I loved my sister and I missed her terribly. And I was worried about her because when I heard she'd gone to Africa, to me, Africa was a jungle full of lions that were going to eat her. I suppose it was just like the family secret and it was something you didn't talk about. And it was a great release to be able to write about it. I talked to Duncan before I did and I said, is it okay with you? I wrote about it during the abortion referendum because all the emphasis had been on a kind of a socioeconomic dimension, I felt. And I wanted to make it clear that this went right across social, frontiers and income levels. And that in a way, we were lucky that my family could afford for my sister to go to England and for my mother to go and visit her, you know, and stay with her while she was pregnant. And that if we hadn't had the money, she would have ended up in a Magdalene laundry or a mother and baby home. And there was one very close to my school where my sisters and I were boarders. And I was actually told at one stage, you could see the fields of Besborough through the wire on the basketball court. And I remember looking out at what to me were just shapes bent over in the field one day and a nun telling me I wasn't to look at them because they were dirty women. So we were totally brainwashed.
The shame.
The shame, yeah.
Did it ever come into the conversation about the father of Duncan or was there any story about that at the time?
Well, we knew who the father was and the father went to England with Bernice.
Which would have been unusual.
Until the baby was born.
Okay. Yeah. And did he get to be in touch with Duncan then?
That's another good thing that came out of it. After I wrote that column, the birth father contacted him and they met. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Yes, something else came as well. And you writing about it, ventilating it after all those years still had an effect, even all those years later of them kind of having a relationship.
Yeah. And I'm very conscious every time I talk about this, about that family and, you know, his aunts and uncles on that side and his cousins. I don't know how many of them know, but I just hope I've never said anything that would add to their hurt.
I think you've been very careful. I just want to go back to young Justine again, who I you know, came to be very fond of reading your opening essay. You wanted to be originally a dancer on Top of the Pops, which I think, you know, those of us who grew up in that time when Legs and Co were, a lot of listeners will remember of a certain age, Legs and Co were this dance troupe on Top of the Pops and you'd look at them and they were the most glamorous beings. They weren't almost like any other women that we'd ever see in our world. So you had a fancy that maybe that would be a good job for someone who was quite scared of life.
Yes.
Just to go dancing on Top of the Pops.
Yes, of course. As you do. I loved dancing. And in fact, in school, I was really lucky to have one of the greatest dancers ever as my dance teacher, Joan Denise Moriarty, the ballerina.
Wow.
And she actually used to teach us Irish dancing. My older sisters went to ballet classes with her. I didn't. I loved dancing. And somebody, when I was kind of an early teenager, told me I was too tall to be a ballerina. And I thought, great, that means I can only join Legs and Co. So, but I actually did think it was a sort of a safe option. You know, you just go out and do a couple of dances a week and there'd be nothing scary about it.
That's kind of amazing. But then the notion of journalism got into your head because just through a random conversation, really, somebody asking, I think it was a man asking you, taking an interest in what you were interested in, what did you like doing?
Yeah.
And you said, I like writing.
Mm. When I was 16, a man from Dublin came to visit my mother, a friend of my mother's, purely platonic friend of my mother's. And we were in the sitting room and I would have been in fifth year in school at the time. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't really know. And he said, what do you like doing? And I said, I love writing. And he said, well, why don't you become a journalist? And I said, well, what do they do? And he said, they write stories. And I thought, well, that sounds wonderful. I'll just write lovely flowery articles for the rest of my life. So he went off. And then that winter, I had a poem published in the Evening Echo, which was read out at school assembly to my mortification. And if I read it now...
I wish you'd put it in the book. I was raging that you hadn't included it. It was inspired by a Leonard Cohen song, I think.
It was inspired by Leonard Cohen's Bird on a Wire.
And it's called Nowhere Land.
Nowhere Land.
And you can't remember any lines from it.
Please, nobody look it up.
But seeing your name in print, you say, made you, and I love that, dizzy with joy.
Absolutely. It had the most amazing effect on me. I instantly became a byline junkie. So then I applied for a place in Rathmines. It was the only place in Ireland where you could study journalism at the time, the College of Commerce in Rathmines. It was a 2-year course and they only took in 24 or 25 people every year. And I had to write an essay on why I want to be a journalist. So I was writing, oh, I love writing and I love books and this is my favourite book ever. Nothing at all, I'm sure, to do with journalism. But somehow I got called up for the aptitude test and the interview. And it was another moment of pure white-knuckle terror for me when I walked into the college that day.
Well, we should say your mother, since your dad dying, had been on sort of various medications and tranquilizers and things. And I think there's a moment in the essay where she breaks one in half and gives you half.
Yes.
And you say that without that half, you might not have walked in the door for the
interview. Exactly. She drove me up from Bandon. In those days, it was nearly a 4-hour drive. So by the time we got to the canal in Dublin, I was in an awful state. So she stopped the car and gave me half of the volume. And then I went into Rathmines and I was absolutely floored by the obvious sophistication of my Dublin peers all around me. There was a fellow my age sitting beside me waiting to go into the interview room in a full pinstripe suit and a furled black umbrella. And on the other side was the most beautiful gazelle of a girl with shiny shiny black bob hairstyle. And I thought, there's no way I can compete with these. So I think my terror was amplified when I got into the room. And the only question, the panel of interviewers, there were 5 of them. There were 4 men and 1 woman. And the men I remember were Sean Egan, who was quite a television star at the time, presented a religious programme on RT television on Sunday nights. Tim Pat Coogan, of course, who was the editor of the Irish Press and really famous at that stage. John Healy of the Irish Times and Western Journal.
Yeah.
And I know there was a representative from the NUJ, it might have been the General Secretary, Jim Eadie. But the only question I remember being asked was the one that the woman asked me. She was a psychologist with the Vocational Educational Committee, which was the state body in charge of the college. And the question she asked me was, if I was at a football match and my boyfriend was playing, would I be jumping up and down on the sidelines, cheering and shouting for him? And
okay, when I read that, because we'll go on to say what you answered, right? Mm. But I'm sure you were just dumbfounded, first of all, because it seems like such a random question. The thing I'm just wondering is, what was she getting at there? Have you reflected on it since as to what she meant by that? Because it's such a bizarre question.
Yeah, I think she sussed my timidity the minute I walked into the room and thought I was maybe too shy and reserved to ever be a journalist and to ask hard questions. But it The fact that it was the woman who asked me that question, it's still, you know, that really bothers me. And I was flummoxed when she asked me. And I just, I suppose my instant response was, well, that wouldn't happen. I'd be more likely to be the one playing the match because...
Which was a great answer.
Well, I was a hockey player and a basketball player and a tennis player in school. But it also meant I didn't have to admit to her that I had never had a boyfriend. I had been in boarding school with all girls from the age of 6. There was no man in my family. I was terrified of the male of the species when I got out at 17.
I think what was so, for in her eyes, the right answer would be yes. I would, that would show her that you had a bit of oomph in you, would it? This idea of you jumping up and down on the sidelines would mean that you were kind of engaged in life or that you were somehow, you know, had an outgoing personality.
Exactly. And you know, the funny thing is, it's only just come into my head. I wrote a biography of Mary McAleese some years ago, and I remember writing in it that when she was a student in Queen's University, her husband-to-be, Martin, was playing a football match in Belfield. I think it was for the Sigerson's Cup. And she got so outraged about a referee's decision against Martin's team that she invaded the football field. So clearly Mary McLeese was always going to be a much better journalist than I was.
I mean, we have to tell about how you didn't do that well in that interview, it sounds like, because you were flummoxed, had half your volume. You went off and I don't know if you get a letter or a phone call, but...
I got a letter by snail mail.
So this is your first rejection letter.
Yes, yeah. And it broke my heart.
So they didn't want you in Rathmines. And this was the only place in the country, like you say, that you could train to be a journalist at
yes,
that time.
Yeah. So as far as I was concerned, this was the end of my life. And from the moment I opened the letter, I cried and cried and cried. And I cried for days on end. And my poor mother was driven demented.
Because, Justine, you had... with your lovely imagination, that is comes very clearly from you as a young child, you had visions yourself as a journalist. Like in your head, that's what you were going to be doing.
Absolutely.
So this was, like you say, at the end of something before it had even begun.
Yeah.
It was devastating.
It was devastating. I had no future. This was the end. I was going to be abandoned for the rest of my life, sitting in that armchair crying, unless my mother had gone out to the press, under the stairs, dug out what was then the Dublin telephone directory, looked up Sean Egan's home number, found it and rang him at night in his home and said, please, please give her a chance. I'm a widow with 4 daughters. She's the second youngest. She's utterly devastated. It's the only thing she wants to do in life. And I am eternally grateful to Sean Egan for changing his mind and saying, yes, we'll give her a chance. So I was number 25 to join that year in Rathmines.
It's one of those stories, isn't it? It's one of those two roads diverging or your life sliding doors moment, isn't it? But, you know, I have to mention the fact your mother goes to dig out this book that younger listeners will know. You could go and find a book where you could have everybody's name and address and get everybody's phone number, unless they were ex-directory, but most people didn't bother being ex-directory.
Yeah.
It's just funny to think about it, isn't it? That she could get Sean Egan's home number
exactly.
and ring him up.
And then it was the most basic tool we had as journalists.
Absolutely.
The first thing you ever did when you went to try and contact somebody or learn about them was look up the phone book.
In a way, it was like an internet, really.
Exactly.
In its own
and
way.
The second thing you did was you rang the local postmistress.
Well, she knew everything.
Yeah.
But then you did get in, which is your tears stopped. You stopped crying in the armchair and suddenly your future opened up again. Thanks to your amazing mother. What a thing to do. I just love that. I love that fierceness of mothers. I think I'm going to make this happen. And somehow she did. She's down in Bandon. She doesn't know any media types. She doesn't know anything about that world.
Yeah.
And yet she says, I'll just appeal to his sensibilities as a human. And
I don't think she even approved of me wanting to be a journalist.
Oh, that's even
because
more amazing.
Like, journalists in those days were still men in dirty raincoats standing on street corners with press pass stuck in their hatband.
You know,
speaking
of
pints
which,
the
very Sean Egan, when you did go, he, I think in your first lecture or class, he laid out the sort of what this career was that you were all going to go into. And he said, you're going to expect a very low salary. You're going to have a tendency towards alcoholism. That's in your future. You're going to die years younger than the average person. And then he asked everyone, do you still want to be a journalist?
Oh, I mean, yes, what a start.
I mean, think about it now, though. I mean, I'm sure they're not saying that in DCU when they're
Probably not. But I suppose it's the invincibility of youth. He thought he was frightening us. And in fact, it just all sounded so glamorous. I think he actually told us we would die 7 years younger than the average person, mostly due to alcoholism.
But you made some very fast friends there. And I'm still trying to make everyone hear the picture of you as this timid person, this not kind of, you know, with journalism, you have to go and you have to make phone calls that you don't want to make. You have to doorstep people. It's like the opposite kind of a career that someone like you, who's afraid of their shadow almost, would go into. But somehow you were able to do it. And you do write that you never suffered from imposter syndrome because you always just felt you were an imposter. There was no syndrome.
Yeah,
you were
I didn't feel it, Roisin. Yeah. I knew it. I knew I was an imposter. It was a fact. And I didn't tell, you know, the other students in Rap Minds that I had got in by default. It's funny, since I wrote it, two other students at the time have now told me that they actually got in by default too.
Joking.
One of whom hadn't even got the honour in English in the Leaving Cert, which was the fundamental criterion to get in.
But I love hearing things like that because I do feel like that wouldn't happen now. Like, it's kind of, you know, there was more, if you were good enough, if you were able to show something, it didn't really somehow it didn't matter. You could weave around those things. You know, I often think about when I was starting in the Tribune, and I was only in the Tribune for a week's work experience, but at the time there was no swipe cards. So I was able to just turn up again the following week, even though I wasn't supposed to be there. But it just wouldn't happen now. Like, you wouldn't be able to walk in. Maybe it shouldn't have happened then, but the point is, here I am now because I was able to do that. And it's just, just that lack of formality or that ability to ring up the likes of Sean Egan or to weasel your way into something was more than you can't do that now as much, I think.
But it was a much smaller country too, much more intimate country, I suppose, in those days.
True. So you started off and you mentioned some friends of yours that you made. I think they're still your very close friends.
Yes,
now.
We're lifelong friends and we go away, you know, for a weekend every year together. And we meet frequently during the year, even though we're scattered, not just around Ireland, but one, Anne Flaherty, has been living in London, and before that was in Hong Kong, and before that was in South Africa. But our friendship has withstood all of that, and we're bonded by the love of what we do.
Yeah.
And, you know, just the common interests that we have in the world and current affairs and politics and we could talk till the cows come home and never get to the end of a conversation. Yeah. They're the most wonderful women, each of the four of them. We shared a house, the five of us, when we were students in college. So there was Anne Flaherty, who I mentioned, Rhys McDonough, who writes for the Irish Times, beautiful writer who lives in Sligo. Mm-hmm. And Mary Wilson, of course, of Morning Ireland fame.
Morning Ireland now, yeah.
And Bernie Neilaherta, who spent her career working in the Connacht Tribune.
So you all started together. And
we all started in the same year.
Great friends. Yeah. It's lovely. And I must say, like, out of Rathmines as well, the likes of Alison O'Connor and Katie Hannan. So it was that kind of era of these great women journalists coming through there to do this ONI course and often coming from much further flung parts of Ireland.
Yes.
Because they were following their dream, you know. It's a great...
We were the five cultures and our house was party central.
Oh, really? Brilliant. Now, it was, you described it there, the anorak and the dirt. The press thing in the hat. It was a male-dominated thing that you went into. I mean, in some ways, we can talk about it later. In the senior echelons, it's still kind of like that. You know, there's still things that need to change. But back then, to be a woman in a newsroom in journalism was to be this sort of outlier person.
Yeah.
And you do describe a few moments of, I suppose, sexism, discrimination that you experienced. Because you as a freelance, you started to get good markings, you know, to go to these good events and write colour from them and all that kind of thing. And that caused a bit of resentment at the time.
Finney Doyle, who was the legendary editor of the Irish Independent, he and Michael Brophy, who was the features editor, started introducing colour writing, which meant that instead of going out covering, you know, a fairly ordinary news event, as in reporting style, you went out and you sort of wrote about the atmosphere and your observations. And it took me quite a long time to learn it. Michael Brophy taught myself and a woman called Liz Ryan how to do it. And Liz Ryan was a beautiful writer who went on to become a very productive novelist herself. And because it was fairly new in the Indo, we were given a really good platform, Liz and I. We were both freelancing. We were earning quite a bit of money and we were so busy we didn't have time to spend it. But we were also getting picture bylines and big space in the paper. So we were building a profile with the readers. And that didn't go down very well with all our male colleagues. Even though we were members of the National Union of Journalists because we were freelancers, we could not attend the union meetings in-house. And there was a union meeting at which a motion was passed barring us from the building. And the reason given was that the union wanted to establish that there was a need to create more full-time positions. Now, Liz and I could never understand how that was going to help at all. But what it meant for us was that we had to like go around the country, cover stories. These were the days before technology when you still had to, you know, phone in word for word your copy. Or if you were in town, you had to get home, type it up, then get a taxi to the door of the Indo.
Hand it in
to the security man at the door and then leave. Now, it did peter out after about 6 months because it was crazy. And then there was another incident. I remember Liz and I were both told that we were not to go down to the basement where the printing presses were because there was a risk that we would distract the printers and the edition would be late hitting the streets. I know, when I say these things, I can hardly believe the words coming out of my mouth.
And even, Justine, just you also mentioned, and I'm sure I saw it as well, it's just kind of was normalised, but, you know, the pictures of semi-naked women, say, that would have been maybe on the walls in various newsrooms and things like that.
Yes, and in the pages of the paper, like models draped over bonnets of cars. I remember going to the car show in the RDS and being embarrassed because there were like models in bikinis draped over cars and men in suits with briefcases ogling them.
And it was kind of, that was the way it was. And even you're sort of vaguely knowing it was weird, but it was so normal. It's those kind of things are fascinating. You also had a male colleague who sort of appraised you as you walked down a corridor once. What did he say?
It was a colleague I knew to see. I don't think I'd ever spoken to him. I was walking ahead of him in the corridor. There was nobody else. I think I was going down to the expenses hatch. And
the old expenses hatch. You'd miss it, wouldn't you, Justine? And you'd get this little brown paper envelope stuffed with cash.
Exactly.
You got money.
There was always a huge queue. But this day, there was nobody there. And I was walking along the corridor and this colleague behind me observed aloud, "Justine, you have a good figure, but you've no arse."
Right.
And I, to my shame, I kept walking. I said nothing.
But you see, that was just what you did because you didn't want to also cause a fuss, make a big deal of it. But yeah, amazing that he thought that that was something that he could just say.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
In your 20s, going back to, again, this sort of timid nature, so you're doing all this great work, you're out and about, you're clearly excelling at what you do. So it's like you said, you've never been afraid of people, and that's, people is the lifeblood of yeah. journalism. So you were able to do that. But in your 20s, you did begin to have panic attacks. That led on to your phobias that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And you were actually diagnosed with agoraphobia,
yeah,
which is, I suppose it's something you would still be, still say you have now,
yes. or
so you couldn't fly, and you kind of had to develop all these strategies in your life to almost tame that inner mouse that's very much there, not even an inner mouse, just the mouse in you. Like, tell me about that time and coming to terms with all of that, and especially when you're doing a job which does involve you having to travel, having to be around the world and that kind of thing.
I had my first panic attack, and I've heard somebody else say this as well, and I really identified with it. I had my first panic attack on a bus, sitting on a bus in O'Connell Street, and suddenly thinking my heart was racing, I couldn't breathe, I could feel myself perspiring very heavily. I didn't know what was happening to me. And eventually, I was freelancing at the time for a magazine called Aspect. It was set up supposedly to be the rival of McGill magazine, which it failed abjectly to be. But I was living at home at the time, and one night I was in bed and I got a really bad panic attack, and I went into the bathroom and I started calling to my mother. And when she came out, I was lying on the floor and I said, I'm dying. And she actually called the GP. I'd say it was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and the GP came up and he actually prescribed some tranquilizers for me. And I realized then that I had a problem. You know, this wasn't just still the timid me. Yeah. This was a problem. Mm. And I developed various fears of bridges, walking over bridges. I mean, it's crazy. Mm. Fears of being in a valley, that the mountains are going to fall on top of me. Fears of using public toilets, that I get locked in the cubicle, that nobody will come and get me out. Fears of elevators, which I still have. Mm. And then when my son was born, it got worse. And I think it was exacerbated because I felt I had to live for him. And if I died, this would be a catastrophe for him as well as for me. I stopped flying completely. The last time I flew before I stopped was when Pope John Paul II was going to Egypt, and Vinnie Doyle thought this could be his last trip because he was very ill at that stage with Parkinson's disease, as far as I remember. And Vinnie sent me to Egypt to cover that trip. And I was terrified because I was flying with Air Egypt, and it wasn't long after one of their planes had crashed in New York, had been crashed by a suicidal pilot. So I was in total bits. And after that trip, I stopped fully flying. And then when my son was, he was in a sports club, and they were going to Spain on a trip, and a parent or guardian had to go with each child. Okay. And my husband had recently had back surgery, so there was no way he could fly. So I had to go one way or the other. And I went to an NLP, is it neuro-linguistic
programming? Yes.
Yeah. In private practice, in a very salubrious penthouse in the Docklands, who charged me, I think it was £300 at the time, and told me that my fear had nothing to do with my father's sudden death. It was because an old woman had beaten me with her crutch when I was 4. She was sitting on the window ledge of the shop around the corner from my convent school, and for no reason had started hitting me with her crutch. That was the reason. He didn't cure me, needless to say. I went straight to the GP and got Xanax, and I started flying again. I went with my son to Barcelona. But I still have the elevator phobia. But you know, and you will know this, when you're working as a journalist, you just switch onto automatic pilot. And yes, the fear is there in your head, but the foremost thing is getting the story and being there on time and not being beaten by the rivals. And I am so grateful to journalism because it has made me live and it's brought me right to the edge so many times. You know, I covered the Troubles frequently in the north, and there were some very hairy times. I went to Lebanon, and I look back now and I've had such a privileged life and I have these amazing stories to tell. And I wouldn't have had that if journalism hadn't made me move out of my comfort zone.
The way you put it was very good. You said journalism had made me dare to live. It kept shooting me out of my comfort zone, like you say.
Exactly what it did.
It's so interesting that you got yourself into a career that was going to do that for you instead of, now not that Legs & Co would have been a comfort zone, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You could have ended up just sitting in a room doing admin or something that was never going to propel you into these very challenging in some ways, but obviously ultimately successful experiences. Yeah. But something in you made yourself go there.
Yes, and I realised that I wasn't the only one who felt the fear. I've talked to other journalists now and we've agreed that we all were propelled by the need to get the story, and that you couldn't go back to your editor and say, I'm sorry, I was too frightened. I didn't do it.
Just wasn't going to watch. But also, I think it feeds into something that you discovered, maybe not at the very, very beginning of your journalism career, but there's a moment in the book where you talk about realizing that it was all about making a difference. I had a similar moment like that one time when I wrote about I was freelancing here in the Irish Times at the very beginning, and I wrote about a man, a traveller man actually, and just described his living space, you know, his accommodation. And I remember very vividly somebody sending in a cheque to basically sort out that man's situation. And it was the first time that I, not that that happens all the time, you don't often get cheques in the post with people saying, I want to fix this, but it was the idea that I'd written about something that was then going to have a material difference to this really terribly sad situation, and the sort of joining those dots of that's the point of it. And you have a similar sort of feeling, and it comes to you at the beginning of your journalism career where it's about making a difference, and that was what was propelling you as well.
Yeah, it sounds awfully pious and noble to say you're making a difference.
But it's
journalism
true,
makes a difference.
Yeah.
And without it, the world would be, you know, it would be unsustainable. I had an experience a little bit like that. I did an interview with a young woman who had been really badly treated all her life and was in dire straits. She had, very serious psychological consequences of that abuse, but she was also financially desperate and she was being evicted from her home. And at the time, the late Brian Lenehan Jr. was the Minister for Children. And I didn't know him very well, but I felt I had to do something for this woman. So I rang him and I explained to him that she was being evicted. She had no source of income. She was incapable of working to earn a living. And he immediately sorted out her living accommodation. He said to me, I don't want any
publicity
about this. You know, and time and again, I have found that human beings are wonderful. Mm. Only the smallest minority are not. Mm. And when I hear people, you know, just ranting about politicians, I do try to make the point, you know, they're humans like us. And many of them are in there for the right reasons, not all, but many, and they're doing their best.
And similarly, journalism comes under a lot of criticism. You mentioned that in the book too, that there's a lot of cynicism, but at the heart of it, your experience and my experience would be people trying to expose corruption, bad things that are happening in the world, and making the world a better place. That's at the heart of what a lot of our colleagues are motivated by, I suppose.
Idealism is kind of scorned these days. But I do find that is a common thread amongst journalists. And I just think journalists are the best company.
Well, that's true. We do have some good nights out
yeah.
and some scintillating conversation. We're going to go on to talk about some of your big stories, but I just wanted to mention someone not quite as nice in the political world that you have two interesting stories about, one relating to your mum and one relating to you, and it's about Mr. Charles Haughey. Your mother, back in the day, went to him.
Yeah, my father was a Fianna Fáil councillor, and in fact, after he died, the local party came to my mother and asked her to stand for election. This was many years afterwards, for the local elections. And my father was actually due to stand for the general election a year or two after he died. And when he died, my mother was landed with this, as I mentioned earlier, this huge tax bill for death duties. And she spent a number of years trying to sort it out. And I remember vividly my sisters and I sitting in the car in Cork in the South Mall while she'd go to the accountant, and she would come out red-eyed and silent. And you could see her anguish anyway. Eventually, she knew Charlie Haughey, you know, through my father, and they would have been in Dublin socialising with him. He was the Minister for Finance, and she made an appointment to come up to Dublin to meet him, to ask him for help. Now, I know that was probably wrong, but we talked earlier about the, you know, the intimacy of Ireland at the time, and things were done differently.
It was very normal.
It was normal, and I'm not going to judge my mother for turning in desperation to him. So, still in her black widow's clothes, she came up to Dublin. She went into his office, and he proceeded to chase her around his desk. And at one stage, the door opened and his secretary actually came in, and he sat back down in the chair as if nothing was happening. And when the secretary left, he resumed his chase around the desk. And my mother left in tears and cried the whole way home to Bandon, and went straight to her best friend, Mary Taff, to offload. And so that was what I knew about Charlie Haughey, you know, apart from, by the time then I got to Rathmines, of course, I knew about the arms trial and I'd read the books. And then he became leader of Fianna Fáil in 1979, became Taoiseach. And so I was out for the Irish Independent working as a colour writer. And one September, I was sent on assignment to the Phoenix Park races. There were motor races every September in the Phoenix Park, and it happened to be the Taoiseach's birthday, Charlie Haughey. So I arrived up in the Phoenix Park, and there was a big marquee, and there was a very long table at the top of the marquee, and Mr. Haughey was sitting at the centre of the table, and his acolytes were in serried rows in front of him, facing him. And I walked up and there was silence, and I said, "Happy birthday, Taoiseach." And then this hand clapping started and calls of "Give him a kiss." And I said to him, I think I said, "Did you get anything nice for your birthday?" Because this was my colour. Assignment,
yeah.
Colour.
Yeah.
And he did reply, and I jotted down whatever he replied, and I fled from the tent. Exactly. As my mother had fled from his office, you know, 2 decades earlier.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah. But Roisin, at the same time, I feel very conflicted about Charlie Haughey. I think because he was so terrifying to journalists during his reign, that there was a lot of guilt amongst journalists that we didn't, apart from Vincent Brown, probably, we didn't put the hard questions to him. He got away with an awful lot. So when the McCracken Tribunal came about, and then the Moriarty Tribunal, and his, you know, lavish spending on monogrammed
Charvet shirts
and, dinners and the
islands,
Pocardy
and mansions. And,
exactly. And then our, you know, the newspaper lawyers told us, look, his reputation is in tatters. You can hardly libel the man now. I think we overcompensated to some extent and demonized him. And I think he did some good, and that has to be remembered too.
Well, we do talk about the travel pass as his, wasn't it? Didn't
yes,
he bring it in?
Yes.
And I remember, because when I was growing up, we had butter vouchers, because there was such a thing. And I think it was him that brought in these butter vouchers if you were from a poorer family and you needed help. You got these vouchers that you could bring, and sometimes you bought butter with them, but lots of times you bought whatever you needed and you went into your local shop. But there was things like that that he did that should be remembered. But I suppose there was all that corruption, and then not just corruption, but what he did to that kind of attitude towards women. And that wasn't just him, I'm sure, as well. We know it was general among lots of men.
Yeah.
Speaking of men, you do a good thing in this essay where you list out all the really brilliant opportunities you've had for writing, and a lot of them involve interviewing men, sometimes quite famous men. You talk about meeting George Best, Tom Selleck, John McGahern, who I know you really admire as a writer, and so lots of these great experiences. But you do write that when you're listing out all these brilliant journalism encounters you've had, that a lot of those people you interviewed were men, but that the most transformative moments of your career have been around women and girls. So I thought maybe for the final part of the interview, we could maybe go through that and talk about some of those, from Christine Buckley to Vicky Phelan, Lavinia Kerwick to Catherine Corliss. If you think about that journalism, it starts really with, and I think that's the opening article, is Mary Robinson's election. That was a huge one and a huge moment. And just to remind people who mightn't have been our age, how seismic it was, really, that Mary Robinson was the president. Yeah. This was massive. Probably the biggest thing that's happened politically as for women in our lifetimes, isn't it?
Well, considering women were half the population, and it took until 1990 for a woman to become president was extraordinary. I can't recall the day that she was declared elected without smiling. It was such a happy day.
Yeah.
And I remember being upstairs on a bus coming into town and looking out the window and seeing people smiling, men and women. And I remember men buying women red roses that day. And it was almost as if the men were saying, welcome to our world at last. And I mean, she was such an amazing woman. There was never any tokenism about Mary Robinson, which was fantastic. She had been in the Shannon and in the law courts and had fought for women's rights and had changed society ever before she became president.
Yeah.
You know, she should have been the Taoiseach before she ever became the president. So I chose that as the starting off point, because for me, that was really a moment when Ireland started opening its eyes and opening its arms and becoming outward looking and tolerant. And I suppose what people would say is the liberal modern Ireland. And it empowered other women. Women realised, you know, I have a story to tell. And terrible things were done to me and other women. And it's about bloody time the rest of you knew about this. And so when people have asked me over the years, who was the most impressive person you ever interviewed? I would often say, there's no point in me telling you because you've never heard of them.
Right.
Or, you know, these are women largely, some men too, who were thrust into the national conversation against their will, found themselves making headlines because of various scandals, and then decided that they would tell their stories because they wanted to make it a better place for everybody else and to save other women coming up behind them from what they had endured. So when I think of the people that have made the biggest impression on me, I think of the still nameless people, the woman in the Kilkenny incest case, one of the most extraordinary human beings I have ever encountered in my life. The women and some of the men as well, who were sexually abused in the sport of swimming. I did a book on that and they were amazing. And actually at the launch of this book, An Eye in Ireland, one of those women, Karen Leach, was at the book launch. And when she was at the launch of the swimming book,
yes,
she went public for the first time at that launch, said, my name is Karen Leach. I was abused by Derry O'Rourke, the national coach. I am no longer hiding behind anonymity. And since then, she's been travelling around the world, giving talks to sports associations and bodies about safeguarding children. So at the launch of An Eye in Ireland, she came up to me to sign the book and she said, Justine, I have got back into the swimming pool.
Wow.
For the first time in 30 years, That woman was amazing.
Yeah.
She came so close to the edge and she pulled herself back through sheer strength of character. And not only did she pull herself back, she pulled other women with her and has safeguarded so many children that we'll never know about. Mm. I think about the men and women who were sexually abused by Catholic priests, and within the Protestant church, which we hear less about. And of course, I think about all the great women whose names are out there. And Christine Buckley is just a hero to me. Vicky Phelan, I did an interview with her very shortly before she died. We had become quite friendly. And I sat with her in her kitchen in Limerick, and to see the size of her first aid box on the wall, you know, and here she was still fighting the fight. If it wasn't for those women, and you think back to somebody like Bridget McCall, a mother in Donegal who was being threatened by the state on her deathbed, that if she didn't drop her legal case over the administration of contaminated blood product, that they would take her for every penny they had on her deathbed. What a merciless, heartless, callous state we had. And it's citizens like the people I'm talking about who have dragged us into this much kinder Ireland, and we owe them a debt we can never repay them.
Yeah. And one of the stories as well going on about that damage done to people was the case of that woman who was 15 weeks pregnant and had clinically died but was being kept alive because doctors didn't want to do around the Eighth Amendment. You write about that. You wrote about that at the time.
I will never forget that. That was macabre. Coming up to Christmas, this young mother, I think she was 27. Yeah. She was pregnant with her third child. And she had a brain hemorrhage, and she was moved to a hospital in Dublin and kept artificially alive as doctors literally consulted Bunrocht na hÉireann to see whether they were legally allowed to turn off the life support machine, and decided they weren't. And her children were brought into her. And the description of her physical state by the doctors who went one after the other into the witness box. There was one point in that courtroom when everybody in the room was crying. Those children were brought in to see her, and the nurses put lipstick on her and eyeshadow, eye makeup on her. And her father and the father of those children had to sit in court and listen to that on Christmas Eve. And there are still people who will say, oh, that had nothing to do with the constitutional ban on abortion. It had everything to do with the Constitution. And the court recognised that. And I am sick and tired of the lies that have been put out and the distortions and the suffering that women went through. I remember leaving the courthouse that Christmas Eve, coming over the Liffey into Temple Bar and meeting somebody I dealt with frequently on church stories. And he was laden down with, you know, carrier bags from Brown Thomas and full of the, you know, seasonal good cheer, and wished me a happy Christmas. And I burst into tears. I said, you would not believe what I have just been listening to.
And you do say that this is a much kinder place, and we did come through the referendum and we voted for, you know, women to never have to go through something like that again. And Miriam Lord says in the intro to your book something about you wouldn't believe the half of it and the other half you wouldn't want to believe. You know, the country was a very, very different place. I'm just thinking, listening to you talking about the church there, your mother was quite religious, especially towards the end. What role has the church played in your life? Have you been conflicted around the good and the bad of that?
Yes. Yeah, I actually hung in there right through many of those clerical abuse scandals that I was writing about. I had a granduncle who was an order priest. He was with the Augustinians. Christopher McCarthy was his name. He was very elderly. He was my mother's uncle. And he was living in Cork. And when I would write these stories, he would drop me a line on a little card and say, keep up the good work. Don't be intimidated. Keep telling the truth. And he was You know, if you met him, you would say he was the most orthodox priest you could ever meet. So there were priests who wanted this to come out. You know, it was the institution. I tell the story in the book about when my oldest sister Bernice was born, that my mother and father were summoned to the parish church, St. Patrick's, by the parish priest for...
You have to be churched.
Yeah, to be churched.
It happened to my mum, I think, as well, yeah.
I think it was quite common in those days. And when they arrived at the church, my father was shown to a pew in the centre aisle. My mother was brought to a side altar where this service of purification was done on her after the dirty business of having given birth, which I think actually was the dirty business of having conceived. The birth had nothing to do with it, of having had sex. And my mother and my father were both so angry about it that they walked out and they said they would never go through that again. And they never did it after the births of the other three daughters. But my mother did remain true to the church. I remember early on when the scandals started coming out, she told me that she went to confession. And she told the priest in confession that she was having a very hard time wrestling with her conscience, that she was really upset about what she was hearing. And you know what the priest said to that this by now elderly, faithful woman? If you feel like that, go and join another church.
God. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, though.
But you know what the breaking point was for me?
What was it?
When they changed the liturgy. Okay. And they removed all references to her and she from it. I thought, this is the last straw.
Yeah. But one of the columns that you won your award for was actually about Greaselock. And in that, you talk about the very good people and the strength people get from the community, from priests at these times.
Yeah.
So those things can be still happening at the same time, I suppose, where you can be very aware of the bad and yet the good is still existent.
But I think, again, it's a bit like, you know, I talk about the state has been very, very callous, but the people have been very kind. I think the institutional church is without mercy in many ways, but the people in it have great kindness.
Yeah. Just before we leave it, I'm interested in this change that you've witnessed, and the book is called An Eye on Ireland because you've had that eye on it. And I'm curious about now, because we're not at this perfect place yet. There are still things for women and girls, particularly in Ireland, that we need to challenge. And so what is it that still motivates you, or areas of Irish life that you still think need to be uncovered and to be reported on?
I think immigration is something that is going to come back to haunt us all. I think the way people who have come to live in this country have been treated is a scandal. And we will be dealing with it, and the next generations will be dealing with it. I think that the situation in Northern Ireland is very worrying, and the absence of a working executive there for so long. And I think the lack of strong leadership, especially for young loyalist men. I recently read a book called Closer to Home by a young writer called Michael McGee, who has just brilliantly captured the sense of psychological trauma that is still there and is being passed on to generations and is not being addressed. I do believe there will be this new all-Ireland Ireland in time, whatever it's called. And I do hope it happens, because to me it just seems the natural way for this island to work at its best, you know, economically, socially and everything else. And when I travel to the north now, and it's so different. In the old days, you go over the border and you go from, you know, potholed boreens and the Republic onto beautiful, smooth motorways in the north. Now it's the other way around. And I feel it's unfair, especially to people who are Irish citizens north of the border, that they are entitled to the benefits that the people south of the border have had as well. Mm. So I suppose they're two, immigrants and Northern Ireland are two things that worry me, you know, that they're not resolved and they need to be.
And going back to, say, the Kilkenny incest case, when that woman, you know, couldn't speak out and we don't know her name, I'm very struck these days by these amazing young women who are coming out. They're in their maybe teens, they're in their early 20s, that are waiving their anonymity, that are telling their stories. And often we have them on this podcast, you know. And that is, I feel like that's the modern version of these women. And they're standing on the shoulders of that woman in the Kilkenny incest and Lavinia Kerwick and people who did it when nobody was talking about these issues. But the fact that they're so early after, say, their father's conviction or their brother's, or they're coming out and they're talking about it. And I think it's changing things in a massive way. I don't know if that's something that you're struck by.
I think the future is in good hands. I love the younger generations coming up. And I would say that because I'm a mother of one of them. And he never fails to impress me. I do think they are, by nature, much more open-minded than my generation was, and that can only be a good thing. And they know how to use the mass communications well. I think the age of, you know, the power of disinformation maybe has reached its pinnacle and is on the wane, because people are very aware of it now. And it's good to see, you know, misinformation correspondence being appointed. I watched that on the French TV channel and BBC World, and it's such an important service. So I think young people are very clued in. They might not be receiving their news and, you know, through the same fora that I did, but they're well informed and they do discuss what's going on and they care about the world. And I think the fact that they've travelled so much, and travel is so normal for them, that they understand how the world works much better than I did.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Justine McCarthy. I'd urge everyone to get this book, An Eye on Ireland, because whether you've lived through these stories, which many of us have, or you're younger and you're coming to them, it's such a great document of this massive changes that have gone on in this country. And you write so beautifully, it has to be said. Apart from anything else, everything you write is a pleasure to read. And I'm so glad that you're now a full colleague of mine in the Irish Times and to get to read you every Friday. So thank you so much. And what's next? What's the next book? Have you got any other plans?
Oh God, I've only finished that one. Next, I'm moving into my new house.
Well, that's enough of an ordeal. Well, thank you so much, Justine.
It was a pleasure, Roisin. Thank you.
That was Justine McCarthy there, and the book is called An Eye on Ireland, and I can really highly recommend it. And actually, it would make a great Christmas present for anybody who's interested in current affairs and interested in how Ireland has changed over the years. Isn't she just brilliant? Now, if you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe to us. It really does make a difference. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan and by me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. Talk to us on social at IT Women's Podcast, or email us thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's it for me. Mind yourselves, and I will talk to you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.